We're going to have some important prophecies of things that were fulfilled many years ago, thousands of years ago. Yet we're going to see hints in this chapter that those events of long ago foreshadow events that are to come. And therefore, it is true here, as it is throughout all of the Bible, that you can never lay the book aside and say, it's done and over with. What you're reading there, even in prophecy, is going to pertain to you, even though we may be able to find a way to fulfill it in past times. Now, his prophecy in this chapter is going to concern primarily the Assyrians and the impending invasion of Israel. Isaiah would live to see this, and he recorded it in his 36th and through 38th chapters, that great event of the invasion. But that invasion is used in multiple places in the Bible to foreshadow the Antichrist and the invasion of his army in the last days. And we're going to see such right here in this 10th chapter. Verse 5. I covered the first four verses last time. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send him against a hypocritical nation. That hypocritical nation is Israel. I will send him against a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. So he was going to send Assyria against Israel. And you may ask, did God actually order the killing of all the people that the Assyrians killed? Did God order all of the destruction that was wrought at the hands of the Assyrians? Did the Assyrians have no choice in what they did? Were they compelled by God to do what they did? And the answer is no, and the next few verses will show that it's no. But in the Bible, in multiple places, when God permits a thing, he is portrayed as doing it, as causing it. And one prime example of this would be in the book of Job, where we learn from the opening verses clearly that God permits the devil to ransack that man's life. But then later on, God is talking to the devil, and the Lord says to the devil, have you considered my servant Job, that he maintains his integrity even though you move me to destroy him without a cause? So there God is portrayed as destroying him, yet when we study the details, the truth of the matter is God is allowing or permitting the devil to destroy him. And one reason that I'm taking a little time with this point is I understand that recently the Pope said that the Lord's Prayer has got a mistake in it. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. That according to him, since God would never lead anybody into temptation anyway, that part's wrong, and he was going to use his authority to fix it. Well, the Pope hadn't read the rest of the Bible. Even if God were to permit us to walk into a set of circumstances that would result in our temptation, the Bible would commonly portray God as leading us into temptation. So we have to understand that God is not the author of sin. The Bible is very clear about that. He does not tempt any man, says James, in the sense of tempting him with evil. But at the same time, if God does permit something, it's not the same thing as when you permit something. Because when you permit something, you don't know what the outcome is going to be. So if your kids ask you, can we stay out till 1 in the morning, and you permit that, you don't know what the outcome of that's going to be. God knows exactly what the outcome is going to be. And when he permits with purpose. And with all things being accounted, it's not the same. And you can understand why the Bible would speak as it does. Now, to me, where the Bible said, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, I'm completely content with those words. They are quite compatible with what I read elsewhere, and so I'm not going to be like the Pope and say those words need to be fixed. And even right here, I'm sure that much of what those Assyrians did was through divine permission, but you got to understand, divine permission is not the same thing as our permission. And I've been preaching for years that one mistake a lot of people make is that they assume that if God does good, then good's going to come of it. It doesn't always work that way. God can be good to people, and then those people react in very bad ways. God has been good to America, but the American people have not reacted in a very good way. They're spoiled rotten, they're selfish, self-centered, and God was good to old Pharaoh in Egypt, made him rich. But Pharaoh didn't react in a very good way. The richer he got, the meaner he got, and began to oppress God's people. Now, who's going to say to God, you got to quit being good to people because they're reacting in bad ways? I'm not going to say that to God. That'd probably do me a lot of damage. But whenever God does his goodness, he's going to administer it in a very carefully calculated way so that in the end, his purposes will be fulfilled and the purposes of the devil will be overthrown. God says he brought the Assyrians against Israel, a hypocritical nation. And Isaiah will say here that Assyria was just an axe in God's hand. Or he also compares him to a saw in the hand of a carpenter. But then verse 7 says this, howbeit, he meaneth not so. That is, the Assyrian does not mean this. It's not his intent to execute God's wishes. He doesn't even believe in the God of Israel. Or if he does, he doesn't give him proper respect. This is not what the Assyrian intends. Neither doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. For he saith, are not my princes altogether kings? The princes in our country are greater than the kings over other countries. Is not Calno as Carchemish? Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? So what you got there is a list of three places they had conquered and three places they had wanted to conquer. So how about this place over here you haven't conquered yet? How is it different from this place over here I did conquer? This place, same as that. This place, same as that. In every case, that referred to a place we've already defeated. We're unstoppable. As my hand hath found out the kingdoms of the idols, and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? Here's what he's thinking, the Assyrian. We conquered all these countries that were worshiping gods in the form of idols, and we whipped all of them, confiscated their idols. And now, here's Jerusalem. They got fewer idols than anybody. So, beating them is going to be real easy. But the Assyrian is not thinking straight. He has no knowledge of the true God. Wherefore, it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, that is when he's finished with punishing them with the Assyrian, I will punish the fruits of the stout heart of the king of the Assyria and the glory of his high looks. In other words, I'm going to foil the intents of his heart, and I'm going to humble him for his pride and his glory. For he saith, that is the Assyrian saith, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent, and I have removed the bounds of the people. That is, national boundaries meant nothing. With me in power, I could put them where I want them, you see. I have removed the bounds of the people, and have robbed their treasures, and I have put down the inhabitants, and that refers to their leaders, like a valiant man, reigned and destroyed without resistance and with impunity. And my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people, and as one gathereth eggs that are left, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wing, or opened the mouth, or peeped. So the Assyrian now is viewing the rest of the world like chickens who just laid eggs. And ordinarily when you take the chicken's eggs, the chicken would flap its wings at you or make some kind of noise at you, threatening you for taking its eggs. But the Assyrian said, I took the eggs of the world, and they didn't even so much as peep or flap a wing at me, because they knew better than to do so. This is how exalted he is in his own mind. Now, Isaiah, or the Lord speaking, shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? As if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift up itself, as if it were no wood. Therefore shall the Lord of hosts, send among his fat ones, the Assyrians, he shall send among his fat ones leanness. Or as in Bible times, being fat didn't mean you were quite as fat as we are. In Bible times, to be fat was good. That was a good thing. But he shall send among his fat ones leanness, and under his glory he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire, and the light of Israel, which is God, shall be for a fire, and his Holy One for a flame. And I've always been very disposed to the idea that when the Bible talks about the Holy One of Israel, that's a old word for Jesus Christ. God's the fire, but Jesus is the flame coming up out of the fire. And it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day, and shall consume the glory of his forest and of his fruitful field, both soul and body. And they shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth, and the rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, that a child may write them. So what God is saying, I'm going to so thoroughly destroy the Assyrian army, an army he compared to a great forest, that when I'm done, a child may write them. That is, a child who's just learning to count, and who probably can't get past 10, will be able to count what is left. He said, they shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth. Now, back in the old wars, as the men were fighting on the battlefield, there'd be someone who'd be bearing the standard for the army. And it was always very disheartening if he fell, particularly among superstitious people, that would be a bad sign. But another thing people don't realize about that standard bearer is that oftentimes he was the one who communicated to the troops how they were to move, what positions they were going to make. I've never been on a battlefield. I hope I'll never be on a battlefield. But I understand that on battlefields, communication is critical. And today, they've got their radios and walkie-talkies and things like this, and they can send a signal up to a satellite, and it come down on a soldier elsewhere on the battlefield, and they're in constant communication. But back in old battles, even back during the Civil War, there was someone out there, that flag bearer someone, who was to relay a message to the troops that you're to move here, move here, retreat, charge, whatever. And when that communication was broke down, that army was lost. And that's the reason Isaiah said these Assyrians should be as when a standard bearer fainteth. Their army will be destroyed and lost to confusion. All right, now, a few chapters later, actually many chapters later, over in chapter 36, which you should go home and read, Isaiah will talk about how the Assyrian army came, just like he had himself had been moved to prophesy. They hit town after town and destroyed them, including the towns he named here in his prophecy. And when they would destroy one town, the people would flee to Jerusalem because it had the best set of walls. And finally, in the end, just about everybody is locked inside of Jerusalem. And there is no hope, none whatsoever. That Assyrian army is huge. They're professional soldiers. They have destroyed everything in their path. And so the Assyrian king sends an emissary named Rabshakeh. And Rabshakeh is looking up at the people on the walls. And he's trying to intimidate them. And he is telling them, you need to surrender right now. You pay us taxes. We'll carry you off to a nice place. If you don't, we're going to kill all of you. Take you away as captives. And he said, we got more horses than you got men to put on them. And then old Rabshakeh starts to blaspheme. Worst blasphemy in the Bible. He tells those people, don't you trust in your God. Your God's not going to help you. He can't deliver you from us. All these other countries and cities that we have destroyed, they prayed, they did service to their gods, and where did he get them? They're all destroyed. And then, you know, Rabshakeh, he's so dumb, he tells them, you've torn down all the high places to your God. Well, God wanted them to tear those high places down. These were structures that they call ziggurats. It looked like this. They're flat on the top. Heathens would build them for worshiping their gods. But see, Rabshakeh thinks that since the Jews have torn those down, their God will be mad at them. And it's true their God was mad at them, but not for that. And I mean, he just blasphemes. And you remember old King Hezekiah. He offers one of the great prayers of the Bible. He says to the Lord, we deserve what we're about to get. But in the interest of your name and your glory, we want you to listen to what these blasphemers are saying and deliver us for the sake of your name. Well, now that will work. That will work. And God sent an angel in that army. He destroyed 185,000. We don't know how many of them live, but there are sources that say less than 10. And the only reason God spared them was so they could go home and tell it. Well, all that's setting up another story. In multiple places in the Bible where it talks about the Antichrist or son of perdition, he's a blasphemer. Daniel portrayed him as a blasphemer. He's portrayed as a blasphemer in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He's portrayed as a blasphemer in the book of Revelation. Speaking marvelous things against the God of God. Unbelievable blasphemies. Just like Rabshakeh shocked you when you read what he said about the great God of heaven. I'll tell you what. I would be afraid for my life to talk about God the way that he did. But this man of sin will be a great blasphemer. The Bible, in multiple places, teaches that when Jesus returns, the city of Jerusalem will be besieged. Armies all around it. And the Bible teaches that those armies, when Jesus returns, will be annihilated. So you see, there are a lot of parallels, and the Bible is going to draw upon those parallels in the next few verses. Verse 20, and it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob shall no more again stay upon him that smote them. Now remember earlier, God was angry with the Jews because they were leaning on and depending upon Syrians, Assyrians, people like this, instead of looking to the Lord. And God told the prophet Isaiah himself, don't be making a confederacy with these worldly people. Now God is saying the day will come when they will no longer stay on or lean on these heathen forces, who in the end proved to be their enemies. They shall no more stay upon them, but they shall stay upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. The remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decreed shall overflow with righteousness, for the Lord God of hosts shall make a determined, or a consumption even determined, in the midst of the land. Now there's some hard verses, and I think those verses are getting real deep. Those verses are getting real deep. Because when we get over into Romans chapter 9, Paul is going to apply those verses to his times. And I think I can also apply those verses to future times. All right, now let's read what Paul said about these verses in Romans 9. Then we'll consider both together. Let's start at verse 22, Romans 9. What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction, and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he had afore prepared unto glory, even us, whom he hath called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. As he saith in Osi, that's Hosea, I will call them my people which were not my people, and her beloved which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there shall they be called the children of the living God. So in Hosea, the children of Israel had been written off. The Gentiles had long been written off. But there was a prophecy over there that the day would come when these written off, condemned people would be the children of the living God. When I say they were written off, I may be using confusing language. That does not mean they were taken out of the Lamb's Book of Life. But in temporal matters, they were rejected peoples but brought back by Jesus Christ. All right, now is when he quotes Isaiah. Isaiah also crieth concerning Israel, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. For he will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, because a short work will the Lord make upon the earth. Now right there, Paul applied that text to his times, and the remnant, according to his interpretation, was that small group of Jewish believers who were in the New Testament church. And in the next chapter, he will refer to them as a remnant. Even so, there is at this present time a remnant according to the election of grace. So, that tells us what Isaiah meant when he talked about a consumption determined in the midst of the land. The word consumption means a destruction. That in the days of Christ, there would be a total destruction of the land of Israel at the hand of the Romans. But he said the decree accompanying this would overflow with righteousness. The consumption decreed shall overflow with righteousness. That's what Isaiah said. And I suspect if you were to go read three or four different commentaries on that verse, you'd get three or four different answers. But I believe Isaiah is seeing the enigma that at a time when Israel would be consumed, there would also be the wonderful news of Jesus of overflowing righteousness that would cleanse not only his people in Israel, but his people among the Gentiles. I mean, there's two things happening there that people would think to be contradictory until they read the Bible. The Jews are going to be destroyed. The Jews are going to be dispersed. And yet everybody is going to be cleansed of their sins, or everybody amongst God's elect family. Then we go back to Romans 9, where I just read, and we see that Paul didn't use the exact same wording that Isaiah used when Paul quoted him. And I used to hear Dad say this all the time, and he was right. When you see a New Testament writer quoting an Old Testament text and he's using different wording, that doesn't mean he's misquoting it. It means he is elucidating it. He is clarifying its meaning. Paul said that what Isaiah meant was this: a remnant would be saved in Israel, because a short work would God make on the earth. And that short work would end with a consumption or total destruction of that people. And you'd have to say, God's work with Israel was indeed short. After all those years of prophesying about Jesus, Jesus lived only 33 years, died as a young man. His ministry was only 3.5 years. After he died, the apostles probably labored with the Jews for about 3.5 years. And from that point, the word went to the Gentiles primarily. And only 40 years after Jesus died, the Jews were destroyed and dispersed all over the world. And by the way, God's remaining works with that people will be a short work. When the man of sin appears for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened, said Jesus Christ. He'll rule for only 3.5 years. And I say, when God turns the Jews to Christ, it's not going to be an evolutionary process. It's going to happen fast. Those hearts will be turned very, very quickly. So it's amazing how much Bible was fulfilled and how little time or short work will the Lord make upon the earth. So the prophet here is telling us that even though Israel be numerous, a remnant shall be saved. And really, that has application to more than one time. The Assyrians were destroyed, but then their near kin, the Babylonians, came a few years later, and the Babylonians totally destroyed the land. They carried the Jews off captive. The Jews were in Babylon 70 years. Then they began to return back to their home. But here's one thing a lot of people don't know about this. Most of them stayed in Babylon. Most of those Jews who got carried off to Babylon were happy to stay there. It was just a remnant that returned. And then of that remnant, there was yet another remnant who were true and faithful to God. Then, in the times of Jesus Christ, this prophecy is repeated, when only a remnant of the Jewish people were followers of Jesus, and the rest of them were carried away by the Romans and destroyed. And I think that before the man of sin appears, there'll be that remnant again, a very special group of people who are prophesied in numerous places in the Bible. Very, very special group of people. And though at a later point, God will change the hearts of the people on a broader scale, it starts with a remnant that may consist of 144,000, which is not a whole lot of people compared to how many you're dealing with. And I'm going to stop here for tonight. But one thing he's about to say is that when God deals with the ultimate Assyrian, the Antichrist and his armies, that it's going to be like it was in the days of Midian at the rock of Oreb. Second time in the book of Isaiah that we've been told there's something about the last days that is being portrayed in Midian and the destruction of Midian in the days of Gideon. You know that story, the days of Gideon. And by the way, over in the 83rd Psalm, which is one of the most prophetic of all the Psalms, and it's a Psalm that the TV preachers have preached a lot about in the last few years, the 83rd Psalm, it again draws a parallel between the last days and what happened under Gideon to those Midianites. And I'm going to finish here just so you can have an idea what God means when he's talking about a remnant and how small a remnant can be. All right, so you remember reading the story of Gideon, which again parallels with the last days. If you don't remember it, it's in Judges chapter 7. You need to go read that story. Talks about the Midianites came into the land. Their numbers were as the sand of the sea. And to me, that is not an expression that the Bible uses loosely. Time and again, that expression is used with reference to the wicked in the last days. You remember Gog and Magog in Revelation chapter 20. Their numbers were as the sand of the sea. And so Gideon puts together an army of over 30,000 men. And God says to Gideon, you got way too many. That's way too many. Well, it was nothing in comparison to what they were about to fight. But God said, you got way too many. And you got enough there that people will say you did it instead of me. So the Lord says, you go down there to those soldiers and you say to them, whoever is scared, you go home. Well, I got rid of about two-thirds of them right there. That's probably where I would have gone too. Whoever's scared, go home. And I think it was over 20,000 of them left right then. Then God says to Gideon, you still got way, way too many. So you take them down to the water and let them drink. And the ones that drink like a dog, you keep them. But the others, who get down on their hands and knees. I'll explain this in a minute. Those who drink by other means, you tell them to go home. Well, when they go down there and find out how many drink like a dog, it's 300. You see, when a dog drinks water, he is still watching. A lot of other animals, they just stick their head down, start drinking, and maybe you don't watch when you drink, but a dog, when he drinks, he's still watching. He's still looking around. So in step one, we got rid of the faithless. And in step two, we got rid of the ones who aren't watching. And what are we left with? Less than 1% of what we started with. 99% of Gideon's army was told to go home. That's what God means by a remnant. It ain't much. It ain't much. But with those 300, the Midianites were destroyed. And I'd love to talk to you about some types that are in that as well. But it's time to quit. And that gives us something to look forward to for next time. Do you believe in Jesus, but you've not been baptized in his name and united with his church? Step forward now, and we will sing one verse, 287.